the third of four streams tonight, and this is with Semi O'Gog. And you'll have noticed that my camera is not switched on. That's because I'm going to be eating a pizza during this stream, and I don't want people moaning about the optics of me eating on stream, because it's understandable. People don't like it. I understand. It's I basically agree with you. So I'm doing you the favor of keeping my camera switched off for now. Now, Semi O'Gog, you appeared last year. And thank you very much for agreeing to appear again, because our discussion last year was one of my favorites from Millennial last year. It was very interesting. I think at that point, just to I'll speak a wee bit initially. I think at that point you had had a lot of objections and a sort of an innate bad reaction to identitarian politics, metapolitics. And I think by the time of last December, a year ago, I think you were coming around to the idea that in order to, because you're more of a libertarian, and I think you were coming to the conclusion that in order to preserve personal liberty, it needed to be a largely European society. Would that be a fair summary?
Yes, except that I have never really called myself that. I had a few people call me that when I got back from living abroad. People were saying, oh, you know, I can tell you what you are. You're a libertarian. I had an old friend who kept saying that to me because he listened to libertarian radio programs. But when I was younger, I thought of myself as an anarchist, you know. But now the more I see of what libertarians, you know, so described, are saying and doing, I'm having much the same reaction that I had when I recently, just for the hell of it, looked at some conference that was going on in some tropical island or some, you know, something further south. There was some sort of anarchist conference, and I saw these mumbling simpletons get up and speak their piece. And I found myself, you know, rejecting it. You know, it was just everything about me was like, what the hell are you talking about? So yes, I think I would call it more someone who has a very strong focus on individuation and the development of individuals. And you're well aware of, you know, what kind of response that elicits from many people on the so-called dissident right these days. I don't really feel as though I've changed a great deal. I think you're quite right that I think that the maintenance of individual liberties, as well as a cultural framework that fosters and encourages individuation, for one to have those things, you have to defend Western culture. And that thing that I mentioned in my last discussion with you last year, and thank you, by the way, while we're on the subject, very much for having me on again, I mentioned that bit about how you can test genetics and there's no way to test beliefs. You know, and I mentioned that old Sufi story about the guy who's searching in the dark for his keys, in the light for his keys, even though he lost them off in the dark, and the importance of the fact that he was searching where there happened to be light. I really still hold with that. There's just no way to test what people believe. There's nothing there. You can't admit in most cases, as far as I'm aware of, you cannot admit, for example, polygraph tests in a court of law, because they're recognized as being just a crock of bullshit. And so that's a very real question. If we're going to organize polities or nations based on some principle, or at least, you know, in my view, there's the idea of a balance between ethnic and civic nationalism, there has to be some basis for it. And so it occurs to me that perhaps we should start thinking about having that discussion based upon the things that we can test rather than the things that thus far we're utterly unable to test. I realize that's a statement that doesn't have the cherry on top yet. It hasn't been worked out, but it just seems to me odd to be approaching it from a direction where we have no ability to empirically test anything. When we do have certain ways to test things genetically.
Well, so just to be clear, what would be the goal of this test? What would be the purpose? Why would this test be being conducted?
Well, you have the idea of a propositional nation, right, which is the so-called civic nationalism. And then you've got the so-called ethnic nationalism. And I saw a tweet from Laura Towler on Twitter, and she was making fun of David Lammy, which is always a worthwhile pastime. But she was stating basically that David Lammy is a civic nationalist, and she said it shouldn't even include the word nationalism because it's not nationalism of any kind. And that the real distinction is between nationalism and globalism. And so far as that goes, the distinction between nationalism and globalism seems worthwhile. Over the last few days, I've seen at least one of your guests bring that up, you know, in terms of the distinction between left and right breaking down. But it also occurs to me that, as I responded to her, if you've got relative genetic homogeneity, at that point, it's not as though suddenly the political, the form of government that you choose suddenly springs up full blown from beneath a cabbage leaf when you get to like 80% native Britain or whatever. Nations are always propositional. And so there is a need to balance civic and ethnic nationalism. And that's, to answer your question, where I look at the idea of ethnic nationalism. You've got the idea that you can test for it. Where did you come from? Where did your people come from? Therefore, you know, to kind of carry that forward a little bit, what sort of things are we likely to see across generations come out of you? And we can say, well, we can measure genetics and we can look at the vast swath of history to see that there is a certain predisposition, for example, among Europeans or any of these other groups, right? East Asians have ways that they tend to organize things. And while there may be major differences, there are themes that you can see emerge in what they choose to do and how they choose to do it. Or we can even go further and go beyond what they choose to do, what spontaneously emerges, or what like No White Guilt likes to call it, a biospirit. You know, there are different ways that this can be approached, but there are predispositions within genetic groups, if you will, to do things a certain way. Now, there are limits to that and there are exceptions. And I'm very much about exceptions as well. On the other hand, you've got what is called civic nationalism. And again, I want to emphasize that the so-called polar opposition, the so-called dichotomy between ethnic and civic nationalism is false. And you can't test for what people's beliefs are. Or if you can, it's very much in a sort of old-fashioned way of this guy moved to our community and we all kind of gave him the side eye for a while. He and his family. And then we saw that over decades, he has helped with the community. He seems to hold these things as truths because it's reflected in his behavior. But you cannot apply any such test at a border when choosing to admit people. And we know that all across the world, people will flock to the West and they will lie to get in because they're grits and groceries on the other side. They're goodies that they'll get if they represent themselves in a certain way. And so you have ethnic nationalism with a genetic basis to some extent, right? I don't mean to some extent. I mean to say that we're still learning how genetics relate to cultural manifestations and the rest. So there's some question marks there, but you can test. Whereas on the other side, you've got the idea of a propositional nation, and there does not at present seem to be a way to test that in any empirical sense. Now, why does that matter? You could say, well, Laura Towler's right. It's nationalism versus globalism. And yet I would argue that it isn't, because again, if you just happen to have this certain group of people and you've got relative homogeneity with this, you know, loosely related genetic group, you know, you've got fictions like Britain, which includes the Welsh and the Scots, and God knows if there's still Pictish blood, right? You've got the English and Northern Ireland, and it in and of itself is a kind of fiction, but at least there's sort of
believable.
Right. There's a framework around it to say, yeah, we recognize there are differences, but this is a working distinction that mirrors territorial boundaries as well as cultural features that are shared and indeed even a historical trajectory. However, take a look at, for example, the idea that we have whiteness is accepted and ethno-nationalism comes into play, and we all start to think that our nations have these features that should be protected, like the genetic, our genetic inheritance from our ancestors that we want to carry forward in time. You know, the commonly heard trope about how I want my country for my grandchildren to look something like the country that I lived in. And let's just assume that happened. And now we've got to deal with statecraft and all the rest. And we're looking, for example, at groups of Germans that are going to come back from Russia and they might want to live in Germany. Or let's think about a situation, for example, where some aspect of foreign policy hinges upon making a decision between two competing people who both want our help. So say you're in Britain and the Dutch and the Germans get into a big argument about something and it approaches war, because these things happen in the real world. And you're going to say, well, who are we more closely related to? Well, we've got the House of Hanover and they were dragged over from Germany. Saxons are certainly of Germanic descent. Well, we've got the Dutch too, and we have a long history with the Low Countries, and Philip Sidney headed over there and his poems were cut short because he died in the lembics of Spain fighting against Catholics. Well, we've got this history with both of them. They're both white groups. And suddenly you realize you have to make a decision. And that decision is going to be based, one would think, at least in part, on the nature of that propositional nation. It's not just about being white. And that's what I mean when I say that political orders don't spring up full-blown from beneath a cabbage leaf. People have to make a decision about how they will be governed, and that is a propositional nation, which means buying into a certain set of ideals and standards that you will apply. And as I said, you can think, well, they're coming back from Russia, but they've been there for centuries, and maybe they all happen to be much more in tune with collectivization, or maybe a bunch of them want to come to Germany and start killing kulaks, right? Or you say, well, are we going to back Germany? Are we going to back Holland? We're close to both. They're both white people. Well, how are you going to make the decision? You're going to make it, as I said before, at least in part, I would think, upon what ideals they hold and so how closely they align.
It's worth pointing out that, because a lot of people might object to what you're saying here, but it's worth pointing out that, for example, in the case of World War II, there were lots of Americans, American GIs, soldiers, who were probably fully German genetically. So, but yet they went over there and killed Germans. So clearly, and I know that it's also true in Australia. I have a friend whose grandfather was wholly German genetically, but he went and fought Germans in World War II. So clearly there is truth to this. I mean, people can attach to ideas to the extent that it even negates genetic commonality with the enemy, with the ideological enemy.
Yeah, look at the SNP, right? They want to go, I mean, they keep talking about nationalism. It's in the title of their party's name, and they are anything but. I mean, obviously, the people who follow your channel or people who are in the UK are already well aware of it, because so many people have brought it up and have mocked them about it. They want to become a little piece of a much greater transnational body. And many of them are Scots. They're your fellow Scotsmen and Scotswomen, if I can say such a thing, right? So there is at some point a need to recognize that it is both ethnic and propositional, and that it always will be. I mean, you take a look at, you know, somebody wants to, Guy Fawkes wants to blow up Parliament because he's a Catholic. Well, how do the Protestants feel? You know, what about the sort of middle ground following Henry VIII with the Church of England? You know, there are religious aspects which can be political. And there are indeed the sort of ideals that one holds to, you know, in the form of a constitution and, you know, or your traditions of common law. Or if you want to carry it back to something more loose, like the Great Charter, it never has been and never will be strictly an ethno-state. There must be a proposition that everyone agrees to about how you will be governed, and that will be based on formulating that, for example, as a constitution, and people buying into it. I mean, that's all our common law traditions are, since, you know, we in the U.S. share them, I mean, with the exception of Louisiana and New Mexico, which are more statutory law, we share that background. So I guess to come all the way back around, we've got a situation where people are not fully recognizing that. And I think it's a false dichotomy. And like all false dichotomies, it's used to get a lever up under people and move them. It's the old line about if somebody tells you you have only two choices, put your hand on your wallet and back up because it's a scam. And I'm not suggesting in any way that I think Laura Tyler is trying to scam anyone. But I think that that false dichotomy is being used as a lever. And there are, you know, I won't go into it now, but there are many ways that we could discuss that. You know, everybody's like, well, let's just focus on whiteness. And we don't have to define that, but let's just focus on the fact that we're all white. But we don't need to define white because that'll lead to a purity spiral. But we're all white. And that means that we're all together and we should all work together. And as I stated in a clip when talking with JF, which has since been taken down, that's a piece of empty space waiting for someone to come and plant a flag in it and to direct it. So if we're saying we all got to get together, but we don't have to have any kind of discussion about the propositional dimensions of our nation, or our nationhood, it's enough that we all do whatever it is that we're told that will support white people. Well, that illustrates the issue that I'm talking about there, because it's waiting for someone to come in and plant a flag in it. Is it going to be a Dugan-esque kind of flag? Is it going to be something out of common law? Is it going to be the much despised AMNAT civic nationalism with its focus on propositions? So I guess what I'm saying is that I don't feel that I've changed a great deal. I continue to emphasize the need for both of these elements. And I continue to feel that it's worth my time to support the people who are ethnic nationalists insofar as they're taking care of a group of people who need to be protected and defended because they're under assault right now. But the lack of granularity and the thinking, the way in which they'll, how do I put it? There's a scene, and I've mentioned it in some of my previous clips, so you know, viewers of my channel will probably be familiar with it, but it's the vestibule of hell, and it's represented in the Divine Comedy, in the first section of it in Hell. And it's actually the entrance to hell. And Dante heads down and he's being guided by Virgil. And so you got the wise pagan person and this figure that will ultimately go on what's essentially a Christian journey. And there in the gates of hell, the vestibule, preparing to enter, there are these hordes of people who are just madly swarming and chasing these raised banners, following them wherever they lead. Meanwhile, they're being stung by insects. And that really is the vestibule of hell. It's where the commie dialectic with a capital D, which they almost worship, is brought to bear. It's the point at which we feel that we can't do this, so we must do that. And we mustn't do that, so we have to do this. It's you raise the banner, you know, the signs of government. People will start to joke and call me Eugen Peterson here because I'm talking about things that are allegorical or refer to archetypes, but that's what kingship has always embodied. You have a crook and a flail that the pharaohs hold, right, over there with their folded arms. You see it depicted on the lids of the sarcophagi. It's a crook to hook. It's a shepherd's crook. You grab them and restrain. It's a flail to whip them and drive them forward. And you see that symbol used among Indo-Europeans with the elephant goat or ankus. It's got a projecting tip that you drive people forward with, and it's got a hook that comes backwards. And I think it even relates to the fleur-de-lis as sort of a symmetrical version of it. It's the rod of rulership, which is to prick them forward to say you must. And then the hook that draws them back that says you must not. And in that respect, if people can follow this train of thought at all, maybe they can't, you have there the dialectic. You must do this, you mustn't do that. And by falsely taking a continuum and breaking it into a simple black and white, you make yourself manipulable. I don't know if that makes any sense. So ultimately, to summarize, I'm still very much in the same place. I think of myself as in the dissident right, because I think of that personally as being a broader term than the alt-right.
Yes, I agree.
And I support ethno-nationalists because now is the time to do so. But at the same time, and I wouldn't say that I'll ever be fully civic nationalist, because again, it's a false dichotomy. I support the American propositions although I think they need to be reformed to have some of the verdigris scraped off so you can see the gleam of the bronze again rather than the black and green mess. I refer here to the verdigris, you understand me. But at the same time, I think the ethnic dimension is there too, and that's another truth we have to face, because the one we can measure and the other one we cannot.
Right. Here is what I think some people would say to what you're saying here. All of this is true, but we don't have the luxury of thinking like this. We're in a position where the proposition nation, a design for a European nation, is something for the future. Right now, we have to simply secure that there are going to be Europeans in the future.
And I certainly agree with that, which is why I'm helping. And it does very little for me and my career or my social standing or my likelihood to get laid ever again. You know, so I have put my money where my mouth is. I disagree, at least in, I think, certain important ways with a person like Mark Collette. And yet I support him in the general framework of what he's doing, which is trying to protect a group of people. I certainly support you and what you're doing. I support No White Guilt with what he's doing. You know, JF is coming at it from a very different angle, but in many respects is on board with the primary issue, which is that whites are under attack. And so I am willing to help. So I disagree with you in the sense that these things are something that we need to talk about later. You know, there's the only thing I dislike more than someone showing up and saying, you have to choose this or this. You know, it puts me in mind of the Bronzino painting with the figure of fraud in the background, where the left hand is on the right side and the right hand is on the left side. And you have to kind of pay attention to the painting to notice that the thumbs are on the wrong side, you know, but in addition to that dialectical aspect, there is the idea of urgency and that you must act now. We must act now. Don't think about it, right? It's like the military thing of go, go, go. They'll start doing hand gestures. Rrr, squad, go here, do this. Go, go, go. Don't think, go. And that is always, you know, the sound that you hear, the impulse, rather, that I should say, behind lemmings cascading like furry waves over a cliff. And again, if we do not look at things like how to define white, how we examine the propositional aspect of our nation, then, for example, you could see the whole idea of so-called white nationalism turned to the purposes of creating a stepping stone towards globalism by forging out of the white global minority a unit that is not particularly concerned with their individual national origins and ways of doing things. And it becomes a stepping stone towards uniting all under heaven in the great smoking, stinking charnel house of the utopia in the sky.
On the matter of defining what is white, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but do you find that to be a genuine dilemma? I mean, do you really not know when, is that person white or not?
No. But we're talking about law.
Right. Okay.
And when you're talking about a legal thing, it must be defined precisely, or within it, a range must be established. And even if it's an arbitrary distinction, like you see with a continuum of color, you're like, well, certain words for green in other languages really include blue colors, right? And at what point do we shift from blue to green? And what do we call this thing in between? At a certain point, you have to just go, I'm going to cut it here. And yes, you could say it's arbitrary, but it's still it's a line that has been drawn that will be used as a basis for making determinations at law. And so it's if you want to have an academic discussion, you have to define your terms. In law, you have terms of art, because what we're talking about must be explicitly described. And so, you know, is there a dimension of white that is cultural? And you know, what are we to do, for example, with all the many white people that are fucking mad as hatters?
You know? Well, you know, that it's interesting because it came up with Sargon a few nights ago. I said, when I'm walking down a street in a town in Britain, a village, I don't know what the values are of the people on that street, but I do know whether I feel comfortable around them or not. And that's simply because they are of my people. You know, they look like me. I'm pretty sure that they will think like me. They will feel similar to the ways in which I feel, the way they react to things. So there's that commonality, and therefore the values they hold, the beliefs they hold, are not of immediate importance to me. Of course, they might be of later importance to me, but in the first place, it's a sense of, am I safe here or not?
Go on. Well, I certainly agree. And I lived abroad. It was in, you know, two segments, but for a total of 6 years. And while it wasn't as strange as living abroad, for example, in China, Turkey is, it's a very different place. And to be immersed in that, and then to come back, I have a perspective on these very things that you're talking about that I sort of, you know, earned. I paid for it with my own time, you know, under the weight of gravity, dragging my face down and wrinkles forming and white hair, you know. You pay with the coin of your life to gain these experiences. And when I came back, I remember distinctly going to a gas station for the first time to buy a pack of cigarettes. And I just, there was this strange feeling of power because I could read the meaning in all these nonverbal cues. I could understand all the subtexts of language. I was back. The words were my power. I speak English. My parents were editors. I'm a writer. I understand these words. The language is mine. And yes, so I have mastery there.
But also the nonverbal cues. So not absolutely. Even beyond the language.
All of them. I know, like down south, we call it bowing up. You know, when some redneck's about to get in your face, he'll start bow up. Because he's going to want to bump chests with you, right? Like all the cues, I understand them. And so I agree with you in that respect that even if they're bad, I'm more likely to be able to spot them as such, right? Leaving aside qualifying bad or whatever, you know, just for purposes of conversation. Even if they're screwed up, whatever they are, I can read them because I am among my people. I mean, I've taken it as far as looking at the colors that the different ethnic groups like if you've watched, there was a whole period with Chinese cinema where they were all being carried forward in Hollywood. In retrospect, I think it was just, you know, they poured enough money into it that everybody wanted to give them Academy Awards and stuff. So they would get a commie toehold in Hollywood alongside some of the other commies there. And, you know, there's a certain light and color that was very famous. You know, look at Raise the Red Lantern. They use brilliant lighting. They just have a sense of lighting and environment that's very different. Or if you look at a Japanese film and you look at the kind of clothing the women wear, they have these more pastel colors. They're desaturated, right? Or down south in the United States where you've got large black populations, they're driving purple cars. They got purple houses. They like dark browns. It's almost as though, you know how you hold up a white card for a camera and you use that to white balance? I think that our very skin color is a basis for how we understand or how we're drawn to a certain given set of colors in our environment versus another one. So we are pale skinned. You can see a blush of shame. I've sat with, for example, a black guy once when I was a teenager. We were sitting out and, you know, drinking Faudis on the curb in this punk rock scene. And he was like, you don't think black people tan, but they do. And he pulls his wristwatch off and shows me this, you know, much paler section. You know, and there is a way of reading people that comes with things like a flush. I mean, if you catch a flush on somebody's face, that is a meaningful sign. It is significant. And so we would have to have evolved to notice that. I mean, if somebody goes absolutely white in the face, you're still muted.
Sorry. It's instinctual. It's not something that you learn. It's, I think we're, as you say, evolved to detect these things in each other. You don't even
absolutely
think about it.
Absolutely. And so it's there beneath the level of word-based reasoning. And so there's kind of a twofold thing there. Because it's beneath the level of word-based reasoning, it doesn't make it into academia, which is trained to consider only things that appear as words. This is all a kind of a side thing for my focus on non-linguistic signs and marks. But it also means that it's going to be impacting you. How shall I say? It will be stimulating in you in some way that is more immediate than those things that you can process rationally. And to the extent that that is so, it's going to have an effect on how you behave, what you do, how you respond. And most importantly, it's going to have an effect on how you respond in situations where you don't have time to think what comes naturally. And that's where we enter the realm of instinct. So I'm not quite sure what the point of divergence was now for talking about the different colors of the faces. But I guess the point there was...
Sorry, I keep muting and then forgetting that I've muted. Sorry, my apologies. I made the point that I know that when I'm among my people, when I'm among other British, yes, but also white people, and therefore there is a sense of calm, a sense of, as you said, power or agency. Like, I know the situation. And so I don't need to know that, well, that guy's a socialist and that guy's a crusty old conservative and that guy's a communist. Doesn't immediately matter. I mean, but I think this is the whole point that you're making, that it does matter eventually.
Yes, and perhaps sooner than you might think, because there's the old hackneyed expression about, let me see if I can not screw it up. If you can have something quick or you can have it cheap, how does it go? Basically, the idea, God, I'm totally ruining this. What an embarrassment I am to myself. The idea is that you can either do it quickly or you could do it well and cheaply, right? These are the sort of the axes on the chart. And if you don't have a whole shitload of money, then if you want to get it done well, then you're going to have to take considerable time, right? Or if you want to get it done well, but you have a short amount of time, you're going to drain your bank account. Right. So there are these things. It's a balancing act. And when you're weak, this matters. When you have fuck all and you're the last man on the totem pole, when you're dealing with people who've already had 50 or more years of a long march through the institutions, then you're faced with this idea of, what am I going to do about this? How am I going to attempt to affect this? Well, we don't, let us say, for purposes of conversation, we do not have the luxury of saying, oh, well, when it gets down to the wire and there's just 1 year left to affect this, you know, we'll just pour a ton of money into it because no worries. No, we don't have that. People like Soros have that. They can turn in that direction, which means that the best chance we have, taking a sort of Sun Tzu approach to looking far enough ahead in time in order to be effective. Because remember, the central principle with Sun Tzu is the guy who has to get up and fight and win a Pyrrhic victory and lose thousands of soldiers and be, you know, commemorated in some Wagner opera. That person is a master of the art of battles, not a master of the art of war. The master of the art of war never gets up from his fucking divan. He's chilling out.
Every war is won before it is fought.
By looking far enough ahead in time. And so that, I would say, in response to your thing about, you know, it doesn't matter, let's just focus on our people now. And I'm telling you that it is a gaping hole. It's a huge empty space that someone is coming to plant a flag in. And the whole idea of the alt-right is that, you know, or the dissident right as well, is that, you know, there's one group of people primarily that we have to worry about and those that they have subverted. And so let's just stay focused on that. And we're the ones fighting against that. It's not realistic in the sense that anyone has sat back and said to themselves, well, wow, who might be trying to turn this to their purposes? Because they're so focused. This is one group of people, you know, ethnically, or you can take it from the other direction and say they're all commies, they're socialists, they're part of this new religion. It's just this group that we need to worry about. And yet, think about how many people have died with Germans fighting Russians or the English fighting the French. You know, I mean, it just all across history, we've got these massive wars that have broken out because our interests are not based upon this idea that we are all white And if anybody thinks that we're going to simply hop and skip across a few remaining last lily pads, or I should say like Frogger in the old video game, crossing the street without getting smashed, to this whiteness where we all recognize that we're one group. Yes, steps have been taken towards that, but I'm old enough now that I'm halfway through my life. And it's like the compass, you know, that you lay down and you draw a circle with it by putting the center post and the other leg wheels around. That's half of the diameter is what forms a circle. And so when you reach the halfway point in your life, you know that you just have to take this compass and flip it, because that's how much you have left. And now you can do that because you've measured it. You know, an octave is dividing it in half. You know, you've got the full scale. Once you've arrived at this point in your life, you know how much time you have left. And that really is the heart of middle age, when you recognize that I am now at the halfway point, which means I can extrapolate to know when the annihilation of this particular time, this particular coming, will be upon me. And so I'm older. And so I want to look across time and see how to do this beyond the flurry of the moment, because that's where you get confused.
Yeah, absolutely. I know exactly what you're saying. It, middle age, and I've got to just say, I am middle aged.
Fuck you. No, you're not. No, you're not, because I still want to be middle aged, which is why you cannot be.
Okay, then I'm a young guy. All right.
No, that's fine. You're approaching the end of youth.
Well, some would disagree, but anyway, let's just say I do know what you're talking about, and it does make you think. Okay, so this is what I've done with the time so far. What's left? I have this time again. What can I do? There isn't that sense of, you know, invincibility that comes with being a young man. And I mean, young men, I think, just generally do see themselves as invincible. It's a sort of built-in delusion. And there isn't the sense of infinity either. You realize, okay, I'm not going to repeat. There isn't going to be a second time when I'm 25 or 27.
And at my back, I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near. When yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. Eternity, they probably said it. That's from Andrew Marvell's to his coy mistress. He's trying to get laid, so he's arguing to her that she better give up on her virginity now before she's in the crypt, you know, with, and worms shall try thy virginity.
Well, I hope he got what he was wanting. Or maybe not.
Right.
So yeah, I think it's an interesting. I don't know what to say about this, because you're right. We do need to think about what kind of society we want. The thing is, right now, most people would simply say, "Well, I mean, most people who are aware of this, the issue and the conflict, they would simply say, I want a white society. I want to be with that," and that's all that they think. I mean, tell me, what would you regard as the range of options that people have to choose from here?
I'm not entirely sure. And I don't blame them for that impulse, which is why I immediately begin to disassemble it and look for where a knife has been hidden in the pillow, where a nail has been hidden in the sandwich. You know, when you tell people that you must move, do it now, 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 don't think, it's a crisis, do it now, then it becomes very easy for someone to come in and say, well, you know, if you want to have white people taken care of, we need to do this new political thing. And as soon as I hear whiteness, when I'm familiar with distinctions between groups of white people, and they matter, then I think to myself, well, here is someone who is attempting to weld this group of disparate states into something that can be controlled from a single bridge, you know, from a single command tower. And then I think to myself, well, unite all under heaven. You know, what was, you know, what's his name, Kalergi, after? You know, what were these people after in the first place? And by uniting all whites as a group, do we not create a stepping stone towards, you know, if not uniting all under heaven, at least we've reduced the number of pieces on the board that have to be controlled by the deft hand. Now, with that said, I'm not saying don't do it. I'm not saying don't push against back against the anti-white crap. I'm not saying that we should not help each other. I'm not saying that there is not a crisis that must be addressed, but I'm saying, well, it's the old joke about the young bull and the old bull up at the top of the hill, which has been told so many times. They both look down and they see this beautiful group of cows down there in the pasture, and they're all, you know, shining coats, and they're all glossy, and their tails are whipping about friskily. And the young bull says, "Let's run down there and fuck a cow." And the old bull says, "No, let's walk down and fuck all of them." So,
yeah. Very
prudence is a virtue. And how does prudence work? I know I'm going to be called Juden Peterson again, but there's an old symbol, and it's from our culture. It's from Europe, and it is the symbol of the virtue of prudence. And it is a two-faced head. I often think about it when I look at Greg Johnson's little avatar image, although it's got the horns of Zeus, which makes me think that it may be related to something more classical than the Christian virtue depicted here. Well, actually, it was a cardinal virtue from the Romans picked up by the Christians. But in later European symbolism, you'll see it's from the side. So you'll see the head of this old man, and he's looking one way. And then two-faced, so to speak, the back side of the old man's head will be a beautiful young woman. And she, in turn, will be holding up a mirror. But you have to look at the image to understand how it works, because the old man is a man with the virtue of prudence. The young woman's head looking in the other direction is that virtue. She is the beautiful female form virtue of prudence. But she's coming off the back of the guy's head, and she's looking backwards. But she's looking into a mirror, which means she's actually looking forwards.
I see. Now, I thought she was looking at herself. I thought it was something about solipsism. Right,
no.
Okay.
And so what happens is, by looking into the past and using the lessons that history teaches you, the virtue of prudence, seemingly looking backwards, is an effective tool to see what is to come. And so all I'm really getting at is, basically, it's just, this is a complicated fucking business. And yes, we do all need to take action, but it should be considered action. That's all I'm really trying to say. And to bring that all around, since this is really just the first question you asked me, I'm still very much in that position, except that I am more committed now to not wantonly fucking with people who are defending whites and attempting to constructively bring these points up. But, you know, I get a considerable amount of pushback from some of them, usually the people in the comments sections, you know, in the chat windows. But I have to say, as I mentioned in another discussion recently, it's kind of cool, because I normally, like right now, I never look at the chat, because it distracts me from talking to you. And also, I have a tendency to, you know, get lost in my own underwear or chasing my tail when I'm talking. But I have gone back now on some of the right-wing channels, and like I mentioned it about JF's channel, and I look back and these guys are making fun of me, and some of it's very, very biting indeed, but it's fucking funny. They're smart. It's actually funny, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are some negative comments here, but I think there are also people saying that they support you and so on, and that they enjoy the highbrow discussion that we're having here.
Is that what it is?
I hope so.
Yeah, right. We're the ruins of a classical education. We're the last sad vestiges, barely one old stone of Western culture laid upon another. Mm. And this discussion is being called highbrow.
Well, it's certainly more. I think that's unfair on yourself. Actually, I think that this is a highbrow discussion, because I think that 99% of people would not be able to follow it. I mean, so just on that basis alone, just comparative with the average, yes, this is definitely a highbrow discussion.
Man, if you'd seen what we used to be able to produce.
Look, I mean,
it's not false modesty. I agree with you that, yeah, a lot of people don't follow it, but we're fucking pikers, man.
Yeah, I know. It is, this is the kind of thing that I don't like to dwell on, because all you can say is, God, it's a bad situation, isn't
right.
it?
Make the fucking best of it, don't you? Yeah. Barf up the black pill.
Yeah, because in my first year on my channel, this this fact was really forefront in my mind, that we are at the end of a civilization. And I remember saying this to a young member of the alt-light, must have been the start of last year, and it, like, do you realize that we are at the end of a civilization? And and she said, yes, I do realize that. And but it's something that I don't like to go on about, because there's not much you can do with it. It's a fact, and it should be borne in mind, but I don't think it's one that's good for dwelling on. In that sense, it's best to look forward and think of what can be done, what can we do.
But that's kind of like when you were talking to Philosophicat. I want to make sure I get that right. But she brought up the point about archetypes, right? You're never gonna reach them. But if you don't recognize that standard is there, if you don't at least aim for it, and it can be depressing matter. The more you know, especially as you get older, you know, it's a trite shit. But there really is truth.
It's true. Like, I know, for example, that, I mean, this is getting much more personal than the previous, what we were talking about 10 minutes ago, but it annoys me sometimes that I didn't have a much better education than I did have. And I'm not having a go at my parents or whatever. And in a sense, it's pointless to say this, because, well, it's over, it's done. That's 20 years ago, in my case, or more, 20 to 25 years ago. And I do wish that, for example, I'd learned Latin. I wish I'd learned...
And you would have been educated in Latin and Greek as a lad.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I would have just come... That would have just happened. Also, the piano and things
like
that.
And astronomy, yeah, and medicine.
Astronomy, music. And definitely the Western canon, for sure. I mean, and definitely Shakespeare. I mean, I loved learning about Shakespeare. I wish we'd done all of the plays, even the comedies, which I don't like, but you know, they'd be useful. I mean, no one really likes the comedies.
But the fucking turn of phrase, man, I can't get it out of my mind. How many cowards whose hearts are all as false as stairs of sand, where yet upon their chins the beards of Hercules or frowning Mars, who, inward searched, have livers white as milk. These but assume valor's excrement to render them redoubted.
Yeah, it's still fantastic. It's still fantastic. But I love Macbeth and things like that. And Romeo and Juliet, I just thought was absolutely incredible. You know, all of these, the tragedies are far more my thing. I wish I'd done King Lear, wish I'd done Coriolanus, I can't even remember, was it Richard III? I think it's Richard III. But at the same time, you think, okay, but is it too late? Because I'm 36. Is that? It's probably not too late. I can still do it. It's just that it won't be. You know, it didn't happen as an adolescent, so I will not be the 20-year-old who's erudite and well-read. But I could be the 40-year-old who's erudite
and
well-read.
And yeah, you can kiss my ass because you've got all that extra time I don't have. But yes, I intend to. I'm now going to pursue at least a basic understanding of Latin. I've just decided that has to happen. It just has to happen, not least with, you know, translating Giordano Bruno, because all the translations suck. But yes, things can be done about it. But to come back to your main point, yeah, it's best not to dwell too much upon it. But at least some of us should be aware of it and bearing it in mind that there is an archetype, there is a standard, and that for, you know, even a brief time in the, 17th and 18th century, we had this idea of the encyclopedist, you know, that, you know, Diderot's encyclopedia and the rest, that, or even the Britannica that we think about, that's a much later manifestation of the phenomena, or rather of the notion that you could gather all of that knowledge in one person and that they could understand it. And I think there's another, since we're just, you know, shooting from the hip here, I realize we're not following any proper standard skeleton for the discussion, but it seems to me that people like to talk about cultures, and I guess this is a defense of individualism or the pursuit of individuation, if nothing else. Nothing exists unless it's in a person's memory and informs their decisions and behavior. So we can talk about the Western canon, we can talk about all these things, and there's so many, it's food for bookworms, rotting on shelves. if it does not live in the memory and inform the actions and behavior of a person who has internalized it. And so I think if we want to defend the West, you have to understand that some of us who feel up to it, and believe me, I don't, I'm trying, will attempt to embody that role of someone who learns about our culture and heritage and applies these things, you know? And so, yeah, we shouldn't be blackpilled about it, but we should recognize that that is there as a standard. And if you really want to embrace the culture where, well, there's the part that goes beyond just bitching about, you know, our circumstances, and to your point, including bitching about the fact that we're not what we once were, and steps forward and says, no, this is a part of our culture. We're supposed to have people who are familiar with what came before and can act to apply it.
Yeah. This is something that I think is essential. We need to preserve what, I mean, it's all very well celebrating Western civilization and then having some painting or Renaissance sculpture or something on the screen, but that doesn't really, that's kind of hollow unless we have some people who actually really know about this and the rest of us respect that person. You know, yeah. It has to be taken seriously. Somebody has to be the one who really lives for this stuff.
Yeah, and what does that keep alive? Again, it's only really alive if a person's doing it. I studied traditional English bookbinding. You know, there are things that I would never know, and that I even apply to things like trying to pull out a toilet and replace the flange and, you know, do concrete repairs and bolt it down again. There are approaches to carpentry, or at least even approaches to problem solving, that I never would have gotten unless I had had traditional English bookbinding from this woman who headed over to the U.S. when she was probably in her early 30s. And she had studied under Arthur Johnson. So I learned how to sew a book. I, you know, was in the studio with a lying press and a plow and rounding and backing hammers and standing presses and sewing frames and measure twice and cut once. You apply it to life, or think about someone who's a sculptor. I just know from drawing, which I've done a fair amount of, you look at a body differently once you learn how to capture a face and project it onto a flat piece of paper in some way that is recognizable. Can you imagine what happens to someone who has to bring a shape out of stone like a Donatello or a Michelangelo would, or a Praxiteles? You actually have to feel it. There's a way that you see it coming out. You're going to get the tendons just right. You're going to get the protrusion of the triceps just right below the deltoid. And what you understand of anatomy, I mean, that's in you now. And then what does that do to you with your own body when you've thought about the shapes and forms of it? Once you've looked at 500 faces, sketching them, you can instantly look at a face like mine and see that the mouth is at, it's all reversed in here, sorry, because I'm looking at the screen. But my mouth is like this angled, sorry, like that. It's angled this way. My eyes are angled this way. You know, it's bent and crooked. And yet you capture it instantly. Like, these are real abilities. It's not just a thing of I was a sculptor. Like, you understand certain things. You have a way of seeing. I think it similarly goes with someone who has been, for example, engaged in violence. Only somebody who's been a soldier and has seen how someone is moving towards that point of popping, of going off and becoming violent, and they can track the moments. They know that there's going to be a precede. And they know that no matter how much that person has masked their pre-seed, they'll reveal it, you know, like the picture of the guy on the police officer on the train somewhere there in the UK, and the refugee fellow was raising hell with him, and you just see him go boom, and just pop him with a headbutt in the face, and he drops to the floor, and yeah. You slow it down and you watch and you see that there is a little bit of a pre-seed. How can you read it? You know, that goes, that's the same ability that you see in a painter, being able to capture what's there in front of you and its tension. And if the ability is truly there, then it'll come across in the painting. They'll be able to show that this is a person about to do a thing.
Yeah. Somebody said, how long did Michelangelo stare at the block of stone before he made David? I think that's an interesting notion.
I think it was quite a bit longer than the immigrant who got into the, I think it's the academy. That's not actually over at, what's it called? The Uffizi. It's separate. Yeah, because when I went to Florence, it was closed and I couldn't see it. So I had to go to the Uffizi, go to the academy, I think it's called, and see David. Anyway, Michelangelo looked at the stone for quite a bit longer than the insane fuckwit who came in and threw a rock at it and knocked the nose off. Because it offended him. You know?
Did that happen? I didn't hear about
that. That was many years ago. It's just something right. I remember. But I mean, fucking Notre Dame happened, so we don't.
Yeah, that was astonishing. And again, I mean, just briefly, we still don't know what happened.
We don't, do we?
Yeah, and it's like I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, the tinfoil hat, and all that stereotype, but. It really doesn't fucking bother me that we don't
know why. I don't care if it was an accident. It's absolutely inexcusable.
Yes, yes. And of course, there were all of these suspicious things at the time. Like, well, why has it never happened before? I mean, if it was an accident, why has it never... I was just like, what, is it 800 years that it exists? I can't remember now.
I was born at night, but not last night. Yeah, and let's not forget that it happened over 800 years without electric wires. With people having open fucking flames to produce light. You had no way to produce light. Yeah. None. Without an open flame.
It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. And I wonder, because it just seems to have been buried. If there was a moment, and you'll appreciate this, I mean, it's sort of relevant to what we were saying earlier, that there was a moment when I think white people everywhere were really troubled for about 2 days, 3 days, by the Notre Dame thing. And it just disappeared after that because the building largely survived. I hope that if the building hadn't survived, this sense of seriousness would have lingered rather longer. But for that moment, there was a strange sense of unity because it was clear that this was our loss. And therefore, it was clear that we were a thing. You know, we exist. Otherwise, this wouldn't bother us so much. Because it clearly doesn't bother the brown people very much, these tourists that we see, they're not that bothered by it. But all of the white people in these, like the French, white, native French people that you saw in the footage were clearly really disturbed. And it was the same even in Britain. I met some friends that night and none of us really knew what to say. You know, it was, everyone was shaken by that. And I think that alone is a sign that, well, there is a certain unity, actually.
It struck me quite a bit. I remember, like you said, for about 2 or 3 days, it was just like this sort of...
It was unthinkable. It was unbelievable that something like that could just go away. And as it happens, as I said earlier, it's like by incredible good fortune, the building survived. So it didn't go away, and it's very much in a condition from which it can be restored to its probably to look exactly as it did before.
Well, thankfully, because there was that brief period, I don't know if you saw it, you probably did, but there were these, you know, recommendations coming in architectural drawings of, you know, re-roofing it with glass domes, you know, like that horrific so-called glass pyramid at the Louvre, you know, which is just like, get fucked, get the fuck out of here. That whole shopping mall aesthetic. I'm like, get fucked.
There were some hilarious memes that predicting this and exaggerating it. Like there was one that I saw where it was a supposed proposal to have like a roller coaster inside it and a big tower that was a spiral and all this and a shopping mall in one area. You know, it was just because you think it's completely believable. You know, it's plausible that they would actually do that with this building. And I remember I did plan to make a video at the time. I planned it out. And of course, I didn't do it in the end. I really should have done a video about that because I think a lot of people felt, as I said, traumatized by this and troubled. And I think I felt guilty for not doing something about it.
But I feel better, just to insert. Yeah. I was very much like you. And then at one point, I heard distinctly that somebody had put their foot down and said, no, this will be restored exactly as it was. And it was actually like this enormous shot in the arm for me where I was like, yes, okay, yes, it's not as bad as I thought it was.
Yes.
Certain people said, uh-uh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you see, the question that interested me was, well, should it be restored exactly as it was, or is that not inherently a lie? You know, I actually did, and this is, I wasn't sure how people would react to hearing this. I kind of wish I had done this video just to see how people would react to this, because I kind of thought it is not honest to pretend that this thing didn't happen. This thing did happen, and we should be kind of ashamed of it. And but also, just for the sake of accuracy, I think it's right not to elicit shame in ourselves and our descendants, but I think just for the sake of accuracy, it wouldn't be right to restore the thing exactly as it was. But at the same time, I'm also of the mind that yes, we should restore it exactly as it was, because we want it exactly as it was.
I say put a plaque out front that says, you know, the fruits of diversification. You know, I don't know. As you said, we don't know the cause. Absolutely.
Yeah, we don't know the cause. It is a very strange. And what bothers me the most is that there doesn't seem to be any interest in finding what the cause was.
I think it's coming back. I think that there will be hell to pay for that in one form or another. That you don't tap a central nerve of the culture. You don't try to pluck it like a bass string like that and have nothing happen in the end. Of course, I could be wrong. And, there are plenty of other churches that burned down.
It happens all. That's the thing. That's the other part of this. It goes on every single day. Like you hear about another church mysteriously burning down in the last, well, since September, early September 2015, it seems to have happened a lot more for some reason. But again, I don't know. I wouldn't put it past certain powers to do this themselves. It's not actually the newcomers or societies who are doing this. It's some kind of psyop to fuck us up.
Right. And, you know, at this point, the whole deck is open there in terms of what it might be, what it could be. You know, we don't know for sure. But it was certainly something that struck me, you know, as you were talking about it, I got the impression that it really hit you. And it did me too as well for right about 3 days. I remember I was just like,
yeah, yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
It's centuries to make it. Centuries.
Yeah.
And what's so funny is
300 years or something like that. It was unbelievable.
And we focus on that and forget the fact that we're talking about millennia for the whole picture that we're seeing being, you know, neatly thrown into the bog.
Yeah. At one point that a friend of mine made, who is a Catholic woman, she said that it shouldn't be. And she said that it wouldn't be right to restore it exactly as it was, because we wouldn't actually be restoring it exactly as it was, because A, we'd be doing it using modern methods. So it wouldn't actually be the creation of hardcore Catholics who built the thing in the first place. It wouldn't actually be that incredible, but centuries of toil. So it would be a lie to have it look exactly as it was, but actually it's not, because it's not the product of endless toil. And B, it wouldn't actually be... it wouldn't be a testament to Catholic faith anymore. It would be a testament to our desire for a history.
I look at it, though, as basically rescuing what we know and what we saw, and at least making it as available as we can to those who come after. Because, I mean, you can take a look at Nuremberg. It was bombed into fucking rubble. And yet, in large part, the city has been restored.
And I lived there for 2 years.
So you've seen that it is like a little bit like a Potemkin village. You know, you can see that the stones are new, and you can see that they were cut to try to recreate the feeling of it. And you know, those little wooden windows, those box windows that they have coming out of the building where people would sit because they could see the street. That's very much that style there. While recognizing the point that you're referring to, which is it will never be what it was, I still think that there's at least a reasonable argument to be made for, yeah, but we're the ones right here now who saw what it was And so at least in our restoration of it, it will approximate it better than anyone else is going to be able to do, and therefore carry it forward.
See, that was my other perspective on it. Even if it's not, like, we should restore it exactly as it was, because then the wound will be minimal. There's no, it's sort of indulgent for us to keep the wound open. We should actually seal it as much as possible and make the recreated building as close as possible to the original, so that, yes, we will know that this thing happened, but it will not injure us on a day-to-day basis anymore.
Yeah, it almost puts me in mind of the people who are responsible for putting together memorials and museums. You know, it's kind of like, what makes more sense for our various groups of peoples? You know, does it make sense to attempt to put the face back together after a Claymore mine went off in front of it? Or does it make sense to leave it there all torn and with its gaping holes in it? You know, and in some respects, I can see where there would be a value in, you know, saying, if you'll allow the expression, never again, you know. But I tend to think that, God, see, I'm kind of, you're actually dragging me over to be on the knife's edge about it, because, you know, what is the function of the memorial? And I don't know, do you want it to use that particular place as the best way to remember never again? Or do you want to perhaps, you know, build a freestanding monument of its own? And I guess I tend to come back down on the side of make it as close to the beautiful thing it once was. And let's engage in our monument building in terms of commemorating what we're not supposed to do next time. Let's choose some other site for it.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, I'll start to wrap this up. If people have super chats or questions, please post them now. JF is due on in 22 minutes, but he isn't replying to me on Telegram, so I think it's possible that he's forgotten. So I'm not sure, but we'll go ahead with this. So the one thing that came
just,
up earlier,
just to let you know, I actually have to cut out at 9:50. Excuse me, 8:50.
So is that 12 minutes from now?
Yes, unfortunately, I have a commitment to my sainted mother.
Okay, well, I certainly wouldn't get in the way of that. All right, so we'll go quickly then. A question that came up earlier was, all of this is, and this is relating to what we were saying for the first sort of half, decisions and all that, and what proposition do we want and all this. Someone said, all of this is very well, but how do you propose that we deport 30 million illegal Mexicans? This is from the American perspective. So it's like he's reminding you that there is still a practical problem. What would you say to that?
Well, I mean, the obvious answer that even a lot of the people, like, what was it? I just saw Mark Collett debating that other guy.
Goddard.
Yeah, I think it's something. Jason or something like that, or Jesse. Or
James
Goddard. Yeah. You know, even the alt-lightiest of the alt-light will say, and my channel was determined to be alt-light, so I can't diss it too much. I have to wear the hat.
Oh, I don't see you as alt-light. I think you're much more serious than that. I'm not just saying that because you're a guest on my show.
Don't remove my protective cover. Now I'm fucked.
Yeah. Oh, I wouldn't say you're alt-right. I just say I don't regard you as. I think you're a cut above.
Hopefully, I'll remain sui generis.
And I'm not just talking about your hairstyle.
This, yeah, all right. I'm not saying anything about that.
My hairstyle leaves a lot to be desired as well.
This is me celebrating The Witcher, which was just released. For all the people to come on my channel and keep talking about that, I just learned it was a set of books. I thought it was just a fucking video game. Anyway, what to do about all the people who need to be removed? Even the alt-lighty type folks recognize that you can do quite a bit if you just remove the illegal immigrants. And if you take a look at somebody like a Nick Fuentes, you know, just before we got on, it looked like he was surrounded by cops at this TPUSA event. So I don't know what's happening right there right now, but everybody recognizes that if you just get rid of a certain number of people who are illegal, it's at least a step in the right direction. And Nick Fuentes is trying to say basically, look, just total immigration moratorium. And I think that there is there's considerable value. I think it was in your talk that you just had with Zurius, where you were talking about how you disliked the way in which that the right wing doesn't understand what the left wing does, which is that you do things in order, and you do it with, you know, sort of going back to my point too, of like looking far enough ahead in time and having a plan where you don't have to force it, right? And a lot of people make fun of me about it. You know, they're like, you know, why do you talk about bonsai trees? You know, just rip it up by the roots. And I'm like, no, it's our culture. And it's, you know, you can't just rip it all up by the roots, which is, you know, attach the wire to the bonsai, pull slightly, let it grow, pull slightly, let it grow. And I'm not saying that'll work for everything. There are many things that are more immediate right now. But that being the case, I think quite a bit could be done with a total immigration moratorium, removing everyone who is illegal, and then focusing, and I realize that there's nothing, I mean, a lot of the Trump-type people will say this, but, and then moving on to disincentivizing the reproduction as a means to receiving a bigger dole check, while at the same time incentivizing child rearing for responsible people. Because I think we're at a point where the different groups that have a much higher, you know, I won't get into R&K strategy and all that crap, but let's just say that there are lots of people who, or there are many non-white groups in the West who are much more fecund and who are producing more children. You could say, well, that doesn't do anything about that. Well, what it would do is get white people producing more children. And, you know, I think that is at least a first step that doesn't entail anybody happen to talk about cattle cars, right? I tend not to be someone who thinks that territory should be ceded willingly with secession, which, you know, for example, like a Jared Taylor would put forth. Let's just leave it there, that there are a number of steps that could be taken immediately, you know, removing illegal aliens, total moratorium on immigration, no longer incentivizing the birthing of children in order to get a bigger check, except insofar as that becomes a thing that then applies to white families as well, that it would encourage them to have children also, which would at least bring us up to parity, or, you know, at least bring us up, not to parity.
Yeah, yeah. It could only improve our situation. All right. Hi, Ollie. Can you comment on what's happening in Virginia? And how bad do you think things will get as we see a continued rise in left-wing authoritarianism in America as more states like Texas turn blue? So what's happening in Virginia?
Virginia, what's going on is that the state just recently flipped blue, more or less. And there is a major push now, at least that's being threatened, of bringing down a bunch of laws to that would immediately or sort of would impact Second Amendment rights. So they're trying to, specifically, they're saying that they're going to take a certain certain types of guns away from the population. And in response, that has got a whole bunch of people riled up. It has, for example, some law enforcement bodies in charge of certain regions saying, on the one hand, that they might not enforce it. On the other hand, that they would deputize the general public so that they could continue to have the weapons. I don't know much about it. I tend to think, number one, that if you really want to know, you should probably ask, what's his name? John Mark has been following a lot of that and using it as a symbol for, or a signifier. A foreshadowing is the word you were looking for with Zurius in the previous discussion. Foreshadowing what's going to happen. So you could look at some of the stuff John Mark's saying. There's another guy, Forward Observer, who more comes out of the prepper community, who looks at things like this. And I would also just ask No White Guilt, Jason Kona. I think he's in Virginia, and I know he's following that stuff closely. But my general sense is that this is going to be used as a way to restore Virginia to a red state rather than a blue state. I think it's on the back burner. It's heating up just right. And that it's going to be used in ways maybe people don't expect.
Right. Okay. Have you been reading any books recently?
Yes, I'm reading Writing and Authority in Ancient China or Early China by Mark Lewis. I want to understand these different cultures, and I was kind of looking for the best way to get my head around China. And this book is just fantastic because it basically tracks all the earliest occurrences of writing in ancient China and how it was used and what it was used for. And I didn't realize like that for me, given my own interests, it's like the most perfect way to really understand what Chinese culture is, because only the things that are written down are carried forward, because each generation dies. And so by seeing how they use what they use, what they use it for, how it survived, how it was modified over time in their textual traditions, yeah, I really get my head around it. Then underneath that, I've got The Political Religions by Vogelin that I have to read. I started and then stopped. And I've got a pile of shit that I have to finish. And I've got Aristotle's Rhetoric that's waiting. And I've ordered most of the Church Mice books by Graham Oakley from Britain. Children's books that my bookbinding teacher from England used to keep around the studio. And now, 30 years later, I decided to have one of them. They're out of print, so I had to order the fucking things from Britain. So I'm getting these used children's books. They're excellent books, by the way.
Right, okay. So that first one was called Writing and Authority.
I think so, yeah, in early China. But it's Mark Edward Lewis. I'm pretty sure I have that right. But if we're going to talk about books that are most important and that you, Woz, most certainly should read and that everybody should read, and this is the wrong time to talk about it since there are only a few minutes left, but it's called Buildings and Power, Freedom and Control in the Origin of Modern Building Types. And it's by a Scots professor of architecture named Thomas Marcus. And it is just fucking fantastic. This is actually, I'd come on this show thinking I was going to talk about my new thing about how the past decade was the decade of the fish garth or the fish weir, which is where you put upright posts in a stream and you kind of do a wattle work to form a wicker kind of a wooden net in the current. And then it's, you know, shaped kind of like a V. And as the water flows forward, it carries the fish, and they get funneled through that V of the open and closed spaces that you've created in the stream. And then you can basically gather them all up in one spot and take your time eating them. And how the internet and how social media networks are all basically, it's the decade of the fish garth. It's the decade of this business of the emergence of, or the appearance of cell phones, you know, a couple of years before, but roughly around 2010, and how they shaped everything that we're doing, and how there's the spatialization of digital space, but it's not just space. It's also a current that drives you places, like the so-called trolls that appear and tell you there's some things you should say and some things you shouldn't say, the okay boomer stuff, the crooks and the flails, the vestibule of hell, the stinging wasps that drive you forward into the fish garth and gather you up. That's what I wanted to talk about, but we don't have time. But no. The book, let me say it again, get it, Woz. Find it if you can. Used. It's a rather dear book. It may be as much as like, you know, 50 pounds, 60 pounds. But it's absolutely fantastic because it relates to how we are funneled in physical space and how that was planned. Upstairs, downstairs, servants' entrance in the back, how debtors' prisons, insane asylums, and prisons themselves, and many other things, sanitariums and the rest, were all designed to have certain points that were control, and how they open outwards into hallways of doors with guys with keys. And he's got techniques for diagramming it. And right. So you can look at the tradition from the so-called Enlightenment and people like Jeremy Bentham and the rest, and he actually takes the goddamn floor plans of all these buildings that were put together during that great Protestant post-Reformation social movements with the Quakers and all the rest, how schools were designed, how museums were designed, how prisons were designed, and he creates... topological sort of charts that show where the key points are and how they're controlled. So you can see how in a classical building, you can see a ring-shaped diagram of access for everyone. But within an Enlightenment period building, you can see that there's one control point and then it opens out from there. And so that book is just fucking awesome, not least because so many people are foaming at the mouth about Masons and talking about the secret conspiracies, and yet they don't look at actual buildings and how the physical fucking buildings we live in and move through foster certain social interactions and retard others.
Right. What was the book called again?
Buildings and Power, Freedom and Control in the Origin of Modern Building Types, okay. Published by Routledge.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much. One final question. The idea of whiteness has been created by the outside perspective. The one true white state would lead to the destruction of the white ethnicity and its various cultures. We must first internalize to understand which meanings of the white ethnicity are our own and which are whispered in by our enemy.
All I can say is yes. I mean, that I tend to agree. So on the one hand, you've got people who say, yeah, we should recognize this overarching thing of whiteness because we are a global minority and it makes perfect sense that we should help each other, particularly in, as they like to say, dire straits. So I agree with that. But by the same token, you know, as so many have said, it's certainly not unique to me, not even a little bit. You know, we want to keep the variety. We want to keep the differences. But it's going to be an uphill battle. You know, people are, I understand they're teaching Welsh in schools, you know, but I think, you know, Manx is dead. You know, Gaelic is basically stumbling along next to the edge of the abyss. You know, all these various languages and groups are, like you were talking about, I can't remember who it was because I've been seeing many of these millennial episodes because it's just like a fucking glut of good content. But you were talking about the way in which there's sort of this normalizing thing happening with the language in the British Isles.
I think it might have been Artemisian Aesthetic.
Right. I watched that one. Yeah. And so it's something to be careful of, but if we want to save it, we have to bring it to life in ourselves because there's nowhere else for it to live. If all the white people are gone and yet all the libraries were by some strange miracle preserved, we'd still be gone. So it's up to each one of us individually to attempt to internalize these aspects of our culture and carry them forth and share them. I mean, I catch a lot of shit for joking about this historical thing, and I quoted some Shakespeare, and I talked about this, that, and the other thing. But it's because to whatever sad extent it does persist in me, it lives here. It lives here in me. And so if you want to defend against this idea of just whiteness, I mean, look at the Catalans talking about the burro versus the toro. Look at how viciously at times the Basques fight, you know, to defend what's theirs. Look at the stuff going on with the Flemish folks and the Walloons, and I get them all mixed up with the French and Dutch speaking regions of Holland, or, you know, the Frisians in the north of the Netherlands who have their own view. Or like Survive the Jive, you know, was talking about coming from the countryside and being very, very happy indeed to go back there to escape from the big smoke, you know, or me collecting weird Southern sayings. You know, we have to be alive. We have to bring them alive. Share them with the people around you. Make them a part of your speech, you know. Make it a part of how you do what you do. Go to plays, listen to symphonies, try to understand more, try to internalize more and share it with those around you. You're muted.
Sorry. I have nothing to say other than I agree with you. And I think that people are a lot more affectionate towards you now than they were during the first half. I think they've understood that you are a good guy.
I appreciate it, as are you, sir. And don't let these cocksuckers grind you down, man. Keep fucking marching forward. Make the future your own.
Thank you very much, and I will endeavor to do so. Okay, let's call it a day there. So next up is JF Garepi, hopefully. In the meantime, we've been going for 5 minutes over your deadline, Ollie, so I hope you're okay. Okay, so I'll be back soon, hopefully. In the meantime, thank you, Semi Ogog.
Thanks to everyone else. And for those who do follow me, if you have the time, stick around to check out JF's discussion. And Woz, thank you again, sir.
Thank you. It's been great. I've really enjoyed this one. All right. See y'all later.